This morning we need to review for the lab exam that we're going to be having on Thursday. So the lab exam is going to cover experiments 1 through 4. Let's start with experiment 1, which was the bleach oxidation. It's a little bit late that we're doing this, but there is a mechanism that's given in your lab text for this. I actually did a little bit of reading online as well, because there's something about the beginning of the mechanism in your lab text that doesn't quite make sense to me, and I'll explain why. And so this alternate mechanism seems to be a bit more logical to me. I didn't read enough to find out whether one or the other is now the accepted one, or whether it's kind of questionable what the mechanism is. But let me show you both of them and explain why I'm going to go with the one that I saw online. So your text indicates that the beginning of this reaction occurs when an alcohol attacks the chloride of hypochlorous acid. So I'm guessing that maybe some of you, the ion names that you learned back in Chem 50 or 1A might have escaped your memory. So do we all remember that chlorate is ClO3, and then chloride is ClO2, hypochlorite is ClO-? And hypochlorite is actually the active component of bleach. So when we say bleach oxidation, we mean oxidation using the hypochlorite ion. Let me just write that down on the side here. From hypochlorite, we get hypochlorous acid, which we're going to have some of, because along with bleach, you also had acetic acid in your solution. So the first step would be the oxygen of the alcohol attacking the chlorine. Now, there's two reasons why this seems a little strange to me. One is that you produce hydroxide. So now we have had other reaction where hydroxide is, quote unquote, a leaving group. Specifically, our hydroboration oxidation last quarter, we saw a case where there was an alkyl shift that ended up with hydroxide being kicked out. And it's not the last time we're going to see that either. Next quarter, we'll see a variation of an E2 or E1 mechanism where hydroxide effectively ends up a leaving group. But aside from that, there's no huge driving force for this reaction, it appears, because chlorine starts out connected to an oxygen in the beginning of this reaction. It ends up connected to an oxygen, and so there's no change in oxidation state. There's no really change in the environment. So the only thing that seems to be happening here is producing hydroxide. Now, maybe the overall, it could be that this is a thermodynamically favorable process, and that might explain why this might be an acceptable mechanism. But let me show you an alternate one that just seems a little bit more believable, which is instead that the alcohol itself gets protonated first. And since acetic acid is a weak acid, so you're not necessarily going to have a flood of H+ in solution, and since hypochlorite is a weak base, then it seems acceptable to me that you could have some hypochlorite ion even in the presence of acetic acid. That could come along and kick off the water, to give us an alkyl hypochlorite. Whether the book's mechanism is correct or whether this one is correct, one way or another, the last step of the reaction is for something like water to come along, pull off a proton at the same position where the hypochlorite is. That bond collapses towards the oxygen and kicks out chlorine. So we end up with our oxidized compound, and then chloride as a byproduct. This part makes sense to me because what is the oxidation state of chloride before it gets eliminated? So before that last step occurs, what is the oxidation state of chlorine? Okay, I hear a couple of minus answers. I heard a couple of plus answers. Yesterday, the automatic answer that came was minus one, because that's the normal rule for chloride. But if you read more fully that memorized rule, chloride is negative one unless it's in the presence of oxygen or fluorine. And that's because oxygen and fluorine are more electronegative than chlorine. And so if you were to look at that, and we analyzed it the way we did a couple weeks ago for oxidation state, the oxygen-chlorine bond would effectively be owned by oxygen if we're calculating oxidation state. And so only the six lone electrons would belong to chlorine. That's versus the seven electrons it would want to have in an unreacted state. So six electrons versus seven, that means that chlorine has a plus one oxidation state, at least to begin with. By the time the reaction's over, we have chloride minus, which automatically means it's got a negative one oxidation state. So chloride gets reduced because that's effectively the hypochlorite is the oxidizing agent. And then carbon gets oxidized in response. So let me write down here. Chloride has an oxidation state of plus one. Here, it's minus one. And then you might recall, I think we analyzed this already, the carbon before the elimination has an oxidation state of zero because it has two neighboring alkyl groups, two carbons. And remember that anytime you have carbon connected to carbon, each atom gets one electron, which effectively means there's no change in the oxidation state by having a neighboring carbon. If we have a hydrogen next door like we have here, that's going to cause a negative one on the carbon because it's carbon's more electronegative than hydrogen, and oxygen the reverse. It would effectively take electrons in this counting process, and so it would generate a plus one. So a zero, a negative one, a plus one gives us an oxidation state of zero, and at the end, the carbon has an oxidation state of plus two. So this second version of the mechanism is what I'm going to declare as the mechanism. So any questions about that mechanism? Then, let's see. That's right. In doing this lab, a fairly straightforward procedure in the sense that you just mixed everything together, but we did have a series of washes that you used afterwards, and I just want to remind us what the purpose of those washes were, because there's a similar purpose in whichever subsequent labs they show up in. For example, you use this wash, which, just because I'm realizing we have some naming issues, what is the name of HSO3? Yes, that resoundingly confident answer. SO3 minus 2 would be what? If you can all remember sulfuric acid, H2SO4, that ick ending is related to the 8 ending. So sulfuric acid has the sulfate ion. Sulfite is one less oxygen, which would be SO3. But we've got a hydrogen here, so there's actually two different names. The systematic one is hydrogen sulfite, or the more common name is bisulfite. And what was the bisulfite used for? It's a reducing agent. So it's to reduce out any excess bleach. And this is under the heading of washes. In several labs, you have sodium bicarbonate wash. What is the purpose of that? To neutralize excess acid. I don't know if I've commented on this before, but why do we use something like bicarbonate instead of sodium hydroxide? Because one of the products you get from bicarbonate is, well, carbon dioxide. So there's not necessarily much left in solution after that reaction. Also, bicarbonate's a weak base. So suppose that you flood your solution with it as you normally would in a wash. It's unlikely some form of side reaction is going to occur. If you use sodium hydroxide, that's really basic. You could potentially cause a reaction. Think, for example, if you had an alkyl halide. If you were going to do substitution or elimination, yeah, a lot of times you actually have to add heat to get the reaction to work. But still, you might not want to risk putting something that's a more powerful base like hydroxide in when all you're wanting to do is neutralize the solution. Even beyond that, because bicarbonate is a weaker base, even besides the fact that it's not going to necessarily react with anything, you'll end up with a not so basic solution. If you use hydroxide, you might be stuck in the problem where your solution's too basic. If not for what you're trying to isolate, then maybe if you were trying to do another step of a reaction. So bicarbonate is usually the best thing to use if you're trying to get rid of excess acid. There was one last wash, which is just sodium chloride, a salt wash. Does anybody remember what that's used for? For what? It's to force out ionic impurities. All right, so after you did those washes, I think you did the normal sequence of putting it on a drying agent, filtering out, evaporating the solvent, maybe you did a recrystallization, and then you had IR analysis. Which is the following. You started out with an alcohol, which has that characteristic round peak at about 3,000. For none of the labs, you have to remember exact absorbances, exact frequencies. You do need to know roughly that it is at 3,000 for an alcohol. Question was asked in one of the other sections, does that mean we might be given a spectrum and we have to interpret it? I'll just say again, you need to be able to recognize that an alcohol is a round peak around 3,000. What happens during the lab? Well, you oxidize and make a ketone. That also has a very recognizable peak that's more like at 1700. Now, of course, in real life, most of you didn't have a very clean transition to just having the alcohol peak to just having the ketone peak. Most of you also had a residual alcohol peak in your product. So if you had a carbonyl, at least some of the reaction worked. If you had the alcohol peak at the end, then there were two possibilities. Maybe you had unreacted starting material, so part of the reaction wasn't successful. Or you might have had a wet product. Water will also cause an absorbance in that same alcohol peak. So that's the IR analysis that we did. And really, that's all the items from lab one I'm likely to ask about. Now, let's see. For the couple of new people, the question's been asked, do I have questions that are just over procedure? No, not generally. I mean, in the Grignard reaction, for example, I might ask, why is it that special preparation was needed for the glassware? So it's not necessarily asking the specific pieces, but the fact that you heated it because you're trying to avoid water. So you might have to be able to explain something that's more conceptual like that. But I'm not going to ask you step by step what was the procedure, or certainly not something like what were the quantities involved. Now, are there any questions on lab one then? Well, let's move on to lab two, which that one's fairly simple. In terms of mechanism, we're going to use the same mechanism we saw in lecture for reduction. In other words, just a hydride attacks a carbonyl. Eventually, we're going to come back and see a slightly more complicated version. If not this quarter, then we have to next quarter, because the real way that these reducing reagents act explains what they do with other carbonyl functional groups like esters or carboxylic acids. But since we hadn't done that yet, for purposes of mechanism, the mechanism is just hydride attacking, pushing open the carbonyl, which, let me just, since it's so short, let me write that out. Now remember, of course, you didn't use acetone, you had that cyclic, the cyclododecanone. But just throw a couple R groups on here, then it's all the same. So hydride attacks, making an alkoxide. Later on, you acidify the solution. And so you get the alcohol. In lecture, we have certainly discussed the reactivity difference of sodium borohydride versus lithium aluminum hydride. But in lecture, the question that you already have had focused just on the fact that they have different reactivity, which is due to the difference in electronegativity of boron and hydrogen versus aluminum and hydrogen. But in lab, there's a practical result of that, which I think we had discussed as well, which is that the sodium borohydride, if you wanted to put it that way, tolerates protic solvents. It doesn't truly, it will react with them. It'll make hydrogen, and so you'll destroy the sodium borohydride. But it happens slowly enough that you could still successfully perform a reduction. Versus lithium aluminum hydride, where the results would be far more spectacular and unwanted, at least in most situations. So you can get away with using sodium borohydride in less careful conditions. Or like what we did, we used methanol. Again, you did cause some decomposition of the reagent, but we also easily accomplished the reduction. So if I were to ask something about reducing agents, it would be focusing on that lab aspect of it, since you've already been asked about the reagents themselves. Am I giving clear enough hints about the types of things I might be asking? For those of you who aren't following along, I'm basically writing the lab quiz here in front of you. I'll share this with you, this mortified section two when I communicated it to them. An unnamed person from section one, after I got done with the whole explanation, started to raise her hand and then put it back down again. And started to raise her hand one last time. I said, what? Because I was thinking, oh gosh, I made some horrible comment. I'm about to get stomped on or something like that, the way she was so hesitant. But she raised her hand, and basically this is what she said, and I'm going to oversimplify. Is that it? You know, we went through all of it. It's like, what she was trying to say is that seems too easy, I guess, because they had just gotten their exams back, which you will be getting your exams back today. So they were looking at that, and then looking at this, and it's like, which class am I taking? Is it this one or is it that one? And the point is, no, the lab this time isn't that complicated. It's, did you wait until today to start studying for it? Because if you did, then the next 48 hours, you're going to be all stressed out and maybe not as do as well as you should have on the lab quiz. But this is it. There is nothing deeper that, because we haven't discussed anything deeper in lab yet for me to really ask nasty questions about. Now remember, there's always NMR that we're going to start up again, and so I'm sure that's going to be lots of fun for the end of the quarter. But yes, after this test that you just had, I'm trying to take it a little easier, and yes, it is just these topics I'm reviewing right now. So if you've got questions about these, better ask them now. Now, as far as IR interpretation, that is the only other thing about this lab that we really discussed, and it's the reverse of lab one. You start out with that carbonyl peak, which again is a sharp, easily identifiable peak somewhere around 1700, and you end up with an alcohol, or at least you end up with an alcohol peak, because since we didn't do further characterization, you don't know for sure that the reaction was successful. There's a lot of evidence that it might have been successful, particularly if the carbonyl disappeared. But you could still have a wet product as well. So even if you have the alcohol peak, even if you think you really did have the alcohol, you can't disprove the way we did it that you didn't also have water around, which I think is something that I mentioned when we wrote up the lab reports. Questions on lab two. Okay, then lab three, that was the Wittig reaction. Which in practical terms, in lab terms, if you hadn't finished your IR for lab three, try to get that done today if you can. We won't even discuss lab reports until after the lab quiz on Thursday. And so those lab reports won't be due at least until the following week sometime. So you do have a little time left to get your scan for three. And yes, you do want an IR scan for lab four. Because we will not have discussed the IR yet, because I know how much time it'll take me to finish, and the other sections did not really finish lab four. I had a fair amount of work left. So I don't want to get into that discussion today. So even though you need to take your IRs, IR analysis is not on the lab quiz. Now for lab three, once you have taken your IRs, save that sample because it'll likely be the sample that we do NMR of. Now if you already threw the sample away, then just when the time comes, hopefully you'll have a lab partner or friend that can let you borrow some. So as long as you have somebody's to run, that's all I care about at this point. Now as far as lab three theory or the types of things I would ask about, there is the Wittig mechanism, which although we might have had questions on the quiz, I think it was, about the reagents or trying to figure out what substrates reacted with the Wittig reagents, we haven't actually had mechanism in a question yet, have we? We actually haven't had mechanism yet in a question, have we? What's unusual about the mechanism in this lab? Well, we didn't start with an alkyl halide and use triphenylphosphine, as I had showed you in lecture. And I had commented the reason that we didn't do that is because triphenylphosphine is a neurotoxin. And, of course, it would have been one more reaction step to take up that much more time to do the lab. So we started with a somewhat unusual reagent, benzyl triphenylphosphonium chloride. Which you might recall, we did have a discussion of the terms benzyl versus phenyl versus vinyl versus allyl versus aspargyl. So you still need to know those common names. The reason that we discussed those common names is to get at why this compound is more reactive than other precursors to Wittig reagents. And that's because the hydrogen at the benzyl position is unusually acidic. Because once it comes off, the anion that's formed is delocalized by conjugation with the neighboring benzene ring. So that is, in fact, why we could use sodium hydroxide as our base. You might recall in lecture when we had talked about the Wittig reaction, I had used N-butyl lithium as the base to deprotonate this salt. And it's not that this is that acidic. There is a difference in the pKa of this compound versus water, the conjugate of hydroxide. But they're close enough to each other that with a 50% sodium hydroxide solution? I mean, a really concentrated solution you were using, and then you heated it up. So with that, you were able to successfully deprotonate this. There was also something a little bit unusual about the way that you added the reagents in this lab, because you had benzaldehyde that was present at the same time as this precursor to the Wittig reagent. And what it turns out, there's nothing that's going to happen between sodium hydroxide and benzaldehyde that you know of, at least. And so the only successful reaction is for this to become deprotonated, which once it does, remember, it forms that thing called an illid, and then that's what reacts with the benzaldehyde. Now, what else did we do in that lab, or anything else noteworthy in terms of theory? Not particularly, because you did just mix everything together. So other than the unusual order of addition, it still was just a cook it up and then work it up lab. You had a series of washes for that lab. One of them was, again, the sodium bisulfite. Which was used to reduce the triphenyl phosphine oxide, the byproduct that's formed in a Wittig reaction. And then we will be taking IR, but like I said, it's not going to be on the lab quiz. So other than mechanism or knowing about this special reagent, there's not a heck of a lot that I'm probably going to ask about from this lab. So questions on lab three then. Okay, then the last lab. Lab four is the Grignard. Which we do need to cover the mechanism, because it's going to be identical at first to the mechanism that we studied in class. But we use a functional group that's not an aldehyde or a ketone. Now, this actually matches the way that your textbook is written. And I'm sure that you all have already encountered that and had to struggle with that, reading around the carboxylic acid functional groups that we're not discussing this quarter because it's a 12C topic. But the start of the Grignard reaction is like what you had seen before. We started with bromobenzene, reacted that with magnesium and ether. And even though we had covered the mechanism for forming the Grignard reagent, remember that I also had said that I'm not going to be asking you about it. So it's fine if I were to ask a mechanism that you don't show this part, that you just show that the Grignard reagent forms. To reduce the number of steps needed when writing a Grignard reaction, there's a shorthand that I might have used in lecture, but I can't recall if I did it in all three sections yet, which is instead of taking the time to show the magnesium bromide formally dissociating, making the anion, and I think even your book does this, you could just draw an arrow from the carbon-magnesium bond itself pointing towards the carbonyl. It would be understood by any chemist reading it that it's not the magnesium that ends up attached, it is the carbon that ends up attached. Now, the unusual part of this reaction, at least from what we've learned so far, is due again to what functional group we have. Which, what functional group is this? It's an ester, correct. So a carboxylic acid is a functional group that has a carbonyl with an OH group attached to it. Take that hydrogen off, put an alkyl group on, and that's where you get an ester from. And even though we might not have gone through the whole sequence of carboxylic functional groups in 12A, we did talk about esters a little earlier this quarter when I brought up the term chromate ester. Or I might have also used the term sulfonyl ester to mean some kind of double bond containing functional group that has an OR group attached to it. The reason this leads to different reactivity is, well, can be seen in the intermediate that we get. is we get an alkoxide like we normally have. But normally, attached to that same carbon as the alkoxide, we only have carbon or hydrogen attached. Hydrogen if we've got an aldehyde. Here, we have another alkoxide attached, or what could become an alkoxide if it got kicked off. So, normally, when you form the alkoxide, nothing further happens to it until it gets acidified. But in this case, it is possible, and in fact it will happen, that the negative charge could collapse back down and make a carbonyl, kicking off the alkoxide. Because the basicity of what is being kicked off here, I mean, I know this is not a good leaving group, but recognize that you start with something that itself is already pretty basic. And it may be only a difference of 2 pKa units or so between methoxide and this anion. So you could argue maybe there's an equilibrium between the two, but it's not that difficult to transition from one to the other. But if you did do this elimination the way I've shown it, you end up with a ketone, which, since you've got a Grignard reagent around, as soon as the ketone forms, then a second equivalent of the Grignard reagent can add in. This time, you really do end up with an anion that can't go anywhere, you could say. Because this time you really do only have carbon groups attached, and the oxygen is not going to collapse back down to kick benzene off. So now nothing happens until acidification, and we end up with our product, which is triphenyl methanol. So, pretty much the standard Grignard mechanism, other than the fact you hadn't seen it used on esters before. As far as what other things about the Grignard reaction might show up on your quiz, well, remember there are those three things that I indicated that can easily destroy a Grignard reagent, which were water, carbon dioxide, and oxygen. So you should know what the products are from interacting a Grignard reagent with those three things. There is, of course, the fact that we did have dried glassware that we used a drying tube on, that we used a septum on, because we weren't able with our equipment to exclude oxygen and carbon dioxide, but we did do what we could do to exclude water. Now, again, we're not doing IR yet, so this IR is not going to be on the lab quiz for this lab, so it'll be focusing on the mechanism or on the Grignard reagent. Not the mechanism of the Grignard reagent, but how you have to handle it. So questions on lab 4 then. Yes. Next to the left of the carbon there.
Back.
Here?
No, it's me accidentally writing a slash. That should be just an O.
Now, as far as what you need to accomplish today, you are continuing with your Grignard reaction. Now, I know that many of you might not have had the time to do the half-hour heating that it suggested last time, but recognize that your Grignard reagent's gone already. Over the weekend, it either reacted with the methyl benzoate or it reacted with air or something, but there is no more active Grignard reagent left. So you do not need to do the half-hour heating today. You just need to go straight into working up your mixtures. Now, the something that I don't know, maybe it was the way it was written, it seemed to confuse the other sections a little bit. You're going to be using an isosulfuric acid bath in order to work up your reaction mixtures. The reason you're using sulfuric acid is to neutralize any excess Grignard reagent, but I also believe it's to chew up any of the excess magnesium metal that's left. So your whole entire solution, all of it, you need to dump into the sulfuric acid ice mix. Now you do, yes? Are they going to be... There may be impurities in the ice, but since they're most likely water-soluble, they should be taken out with whatever washes that we do. Now, speaking of the washes, since you have ether as your solvent, you're supposed to have the ether layer float on top. So this is going to be backwards from... Wasn't it lab 3 that we used methylene chloride in? So then lab 3, your organic layer was in the bottom each time. But someone from one of the other sections had this behavior, and it really was lab 4 that she was working on, where somehow the bottom layer was the organic. And we verified that, in fact. And I don't know if possibly there might have been some mislabeling that really it was experiment 3, but I don't think so. I think she was more careful than that. And I'm guessing maybe... that if you had a concentrated solution of the triphenylmethanol in ether, maybe it's possible that combination makes the solution more dense than water. So all I'm saying is that, yeah, ether is supposed to be on top, but don't just blindly go through it. Do maybe verify at different stages that you've got the water on the bottom and the organic on the top. Now, I think I get the impression that both sections 1 and 2, many people skipped doing the IR today because I did comment that after the lab quiz, we're not beginning the new experiment. So in fact, don't prepare your next pre-lab for Thursday. Next pre-lab won't be due until the following Tuesday because we need our third day of lab for the Grignard. And I did say, and it is true, you've got time to do your IR spectra after the lab quiz. But if all of you wait until then, if everybody disappears, well, then not everybody's going to finish their IR next time. So some of you, if you finish up, you need to go ahead and do your IRs today. Don't just leave early because you can. Few of you need to work through finish up so that not all of you get stuck in a big, huge line on Thursday. Yes, Carolyn.
Oh wait, are you talking about distilling off the ether? Because there is a mention of distilling the ether, but we're not going to distill, we're just going to rely on the vacuum system like we've been doing. Is that the part that you're asking about? But just because the cyclohexane part did throw off the other section. There is, after you evaporate the solvent, a solubility trick that you're supposed to play to try to cause the triphenylmethanol to crystallize out and leave any impurities behind. You do want to go ahead and follow that portion of the procedure that's there. Are there any other questions? Yes. No, we don't. There's no class Friday. There's no class Monday. No class Friday. It's the long weekend. Yes. So this section does not have lecture, nor the other section. We don't have Monday either. You all don't know that you've got a holiday like that? I've been looking forward to this for weeks now. Finally catch up on work, you know? You're going to be studying. I'm going to be grading. We're all going to be suffering together, but at least we won't be suffering here, right? We could be suffering laying back in our chair watching all the cold rain coming by. Other questions? Yes. Is that it? Is that all there is? Start playing that song. Don't make me sing. That's it.
Really?
I could write a special quiz for you if you want to. Put it on bright, burning red paper, too. Yes. We're supposed to have 3 days, and this is the second day. So after the lab quiz, that's your third day. That's why we're going to do IR that day. That's also why you don't have to have your pre-lab done for Thursday. You need to have it done for the next time. Because isn't the next lab the thermodynamic versus kinetic control? Maybe. It should be.
It will be if that's what's on the syllabus next. I just didn't look before class. It is? You all, I'm going to check carefully your pre-labs for that experiment. So even though they're not due on Thursday, you better have them ready for Tuesday when we come back. All right. Yes? Let me determine that by the time we get to lecture. And you will, by the way, be getting your exams back during the lab, and then I'll talk about them a little bit when we get to lecture. Yes? Don't know. Won't announce it even until Thursday. Why don't we go ahead and get to work then?